Welcome to Hope Leads. I'm Wes Lane. Well, I suspect many of you listening in have worked for an organization of some sort. Maybe it was a small or large business or a nonprofit, maybe even a church. Some of you own or lead workplaces. But I bet if you think back and ask yourself the question, have I always enjoyed my workplace? We'd get a wide range of feedback. So what makes a great organizational culture? And how do you create it? That's the topic for the day. And I might add that I suspect that what makes for a great workplace culture is not so different from that which makes a great homeplace culture as well, since after all, we're talking about human relations. Well, my guest today is Frank Smith. Frank serves as the president of Mosaic Personnel and the chairman and COO of C3 Brands, which owns Mosaic and Strata Leadership and various and sundry other empires. But you're also the senior executive coach for Strata. I've known Frank for perhaps a dozen years, and I guess I should also very importantly add that you are a race car enthusiast.
Yes, sir.
Welcome, Frank.
Thanks,
by the way.
Good to be here.
Thank you. In fact, I should say that before we went live, we've just had about a 10-minute guffaw sharing your NASCAR stories.
Yes.
oh my gosh, it's probably best we didn't. We could have spent the first, and this actually might be highly entertaining. Maybe we should do another program on some of the stories. But I have heard on good authority that you do use some race car metaphor in your coaching and teaching and the like.
I do, probably enough that people that are around me very much get tired of hearing about it and kind of go, oh, here comes another race car story.
Well, I want you to feel free to, if you know there's an apt metaphor, even if our audience has no clue what you're talking about,
okay,
but may want to learn. So just toss it right on in there. Well, I've read this on your websites, and I know this from conversations that we've had in the past, that you have a great passion for workplace culture. Am I right?
Yes, very much so.
In fact, when I think of culture, or a workplace culture, I think of human flourishing and the like. But so that we're on the same page, what do you mean by culture?
That's a great question. It means, it's the environment that you create for your people. It's how do people feel when they walk in to the office, when they work with you, when they interact? Do they feel a sense of purpose? Do they understand why they're coming to work and how they fit into a bigger picture and impact other people's lives? It's, a combination of all those things of higher purpose, helping people integrate with these are my skills and how do I use them to impact other people's lives.
Well, it sounds, in fact, because my next question was going to ask you, so what does a really fine workplace culture look like? And you've just talked about a number of things.
Well, and you talked about it in your introductory as well. It's family. The same things that work in families that make families strong make workplace culture strong, because it's all people. And that's what gets messy. It's what gets complex. But you have to love the same way you enjoy working with your kids or a spouse and trying to work through difficult situations. You have to enjoy working with people in order to be able to create a culture that's enjoyable for people to be in.
You know, it's funny when you mentioned messy, I like immediately had this flashback. And I remember when I was DAI, I had 150 staff. And I remember thinking one day, this job would be a lot of fun if it weren't for the humans. It's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So, you probably come by this, so many times when we talk to people here about different issues, different passions that they have, they come by that, not by, hey, I decided I'd take a college course and I'd go do this, but rather there's something that has, they've been influenced by, they've been impacted by that in their own development and their walk and their pursuit of things that they come by this. And I'm just wondering, so what in your background has caused you to have a desire for people to flourish in a workplace?
No, great question. It's probably one of those things that when you look back, you can kind of see how it all pieces together. But during the time, it's not near as fun, maybe,
yeah, right.
to
yeah,
think through yeah. it. But the first few things that come to my mind, I grew up in a home with a dad that didn't like the job that he had. And he had been in the military. His dad passed away. He had to step into the family business and told his mom, I'll help you get the business out of debt, and then I'm going to go do what I want to go do.
Oh, but man.
20 years later, he got the business out of debt, and he had 3 kids and 20 years experience running the family print business, and he was stuck. And so,
well, this sounds like Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, very much so. And I saw that even as a kid, I could just tell dad wasn't doing what he wanted to do. And so that was kind of puzzle piece A. I go to school, get my degree in accounting, and not really sure why I feel called to business, but I just have this interest in business and how it works. Go out and start working in the business world. And 2 of my first 3 jobs, I quit because the culture was so bad. We didn't use the word back in the 80s about business culture, but they just were places I didn't enjoy working. And I always tell the story that I could tell you what time it was on Sunday by how bad my stomach hurt.
Wow.
Yeah, it just, you know, 8 o'clock in the evening was worse than 5 o'clock in the evening because I knew what I was stepping into the next day. And so I just had this, you know, experience where I go into work every day was a drudgery. And I didn't enjoy that. And later on, when I had an opportunity to buy and own a business of my own, my real passion became, how do you create a place where people want to come to work, where their stomach doesn't hurt on Sunday night, where the lady that's going to sit and work at a sewing machine for 9 hours on Monday actually wants to come to work and is excited about that and sees what her role is in that. And so we set out to create that when I had my seatbelt manufacturing company.
Well, so what had to be a learning process for you right there. I mean, even though you'd certainly coming from a background of knowing, hey, this is terrible. I know what's terrible. Mm-hmm. And consequently, I probably have an idea what's good. And so, but how did you ferret out these are the 5 things I really need to do at my company?
Now, that's a great question. I would say puzzle piece 1 to that was when I was in school at Harding University in my senior year, they brought in Tom Peters, who had written the book In Search of Excellence.
Oh, yeah.
And talked a lot about the customer service side of businesses and companies like Disney and there was a car dealership down in Dallas, Sewell, that was known for their customer service and how they created that experience for the customers where they wanted to come and be there. I was fascinated by that, but because of my own experiences in the workplace where as an employee, I didn't enjoy going in, my brain connected those dots and said, hey, instead of creating a customer service experience that's second to none, what if you could create an employee experience that's second to none? And so my brain started working on that. And this was pre-internet, pre-Google search, you know.
Oh, so it was actually hard.
It was, you know, reading Inc. magazine and then trying to pick up the phone and call these companies that I was reading about in Inc. magazine and get through 2 or 3 levels and figure out who you needed to talk to and say, hey, I saw something in an article that said you guys did this. Can you tell me more about that? And some people were receptive and would share information and others didn't. And so it took years, really, to figure a lot of this out by trial and error. And I had no formal training in leadership. And so I'm fumbling along as a leader, trying to figure out how to do this stuff that's really out of the norm. And people were like, you're crazy for doing that. And but it just made sense in some way, even though I couldn't quite see the end goal. I knew I was on the right path. And then eventually we won some awards for the culture that we had created, got some recognition. And that's really how Strata Leadership developed and became a business mm-hmm. is because people started coming to us then saying, hey, could you help us create a culture like that in our business? And so we started working with other companies to help them be intentional about the culture that they were creating.
Well, in fact, if I recall correctly, you had bought the seatbelt business and then it was it. And then you and and Dr. Nathan Miller start Strata Leadership.
Right.
Around, I think, 2009.
Yeah, right in the middle of the downturn.
Great timing. But had you already sold the seatbelt business?
I
hadn't. You still owned it?
Owned it at the time, yeah, and had a couple of other businesses at the time as well that, and honestly, just got myself spread too thin. I ended up with, you know, I think I had four different businesses at the time, one of which had six different locations, and it was just, you know, spinning too many plates. And so when I had the opportunity to either close some of those or hand them over to business partners, that became the way that I kind of helped simplify my life. And then when I sold the seatbelt company, I went to work full-time with Nathan at Strata.
And so when you, in your pursuit of excellence, if you will, I mean, when you were doing your own research and calling these different companies up and all that, does anything come to mind as being like, wow, I really hit a gold mine with this one conversation and I was told this, and that that really changed things?
Yeah, the thing that would come to my mind first on that is it's a methodology called the Great Game of Business. And it has to do with sharing the financial statements with all of the employees in the company.
Oh, yeah.
And teaching them how they truly impact the business. It's one thing to come in and understand, oh, here's my job today. It's another thing for an employee, one, to know, oh, here's how my job makes the business successful. But it's even another thing for employees to go, wow, my owner trusts me with the financial statements, and he shares with me what the revenues of the business are, what the expenses of the business are, what the profits of the business are, how we spend those profits. And it's probably the quickest way I've seen that you can build trust in an organization is when you share that financial information with people.
Well, that's just really got to probably jam a lot of people up, the thought of sharing that private information. And then you're entrusting it to folks and you wonder, is anybody going to use this against me? I mean, or my competitors? I mean, how has that worked out?
No, it's worked out amazingly well. All the things as an owner that you fear and get worried about aren't really concerns. When you stop and think about it, publicly traded companies are already sharing all their financial information.
Yeah.
They don't do a good job of teaching the employees how they connect to those financial statements, but that information is public. And so their competitors know what they're doing and all that. So the concerns that small business owners have really aren't a valid concern, because it happens all the time in publicly traded companies that information gets shared, and, you know, it's not to their detriment. In small businesses, who's my employee really going to go talk to and share that financial information?
Sure.
That's a real risk. But what it does to for the employee to, one, be trusted with that information, but then, two, to be set loose on a path that says, oh, I can impact and I can help this company be successful. Employees, just like all of us, we all love winning.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can help them understand how to win as a business, they're going to give you more effort and engagement because they want to win and they want to make the company win, just like as an owner, I want the company to win. So it gives an ownership mindset to more of the employees.
Do you find it's necessary to actually like reward, or do you set up incentives, or when people do certain, did you start this with when you had Beams? I mean, the seatbelt?
I did. You know, you mentioned there's got to be some people that don't want to do that. And my experience with that was I read an article in Inc. magazine about the Great Game of Business and open book management, shared it with my owners, my business partners, and the majority of them just looked at me and said, that's crazy. We'll never share that information with the employees. And man, that just kicked me in the gut, because I was like, this is something really cool. And they were like, not a chance. We're not doing this.
Okay.
And so it honestly took me 6 years before I could implement it in my business, because over time I had to buy out those business partners when opportunity presented itself. You know, that wasn't the reason I bought them out, but if they decided, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, maybe retiring, or I've got some health issues and I can't work anymore, I would offer to buy them out. And then once I got all of the business partners that didn't want to play the game bought out, I immediately went and implemented it at the seatbelt company. And it's honestly the reason why we made it through the 2008, 2009 downturn. It's the reason we were even able to sell our company in 2012 because the employees were so engaged in the business and understood how to make it successful. One of the sayings of the great game of business is, it's easy to stop one guy, it's hard to stop 100. And when you get the entire team working yes. on something and getting the input of the people that are actually hands-on making the product and interacting with the customers, and they have that business knowledge in addition to their job knowledge, it really kind of ignites and helps the business.
Was it so I was thinking there a second, I said, I wonder what the metrics are to be able to connect between, all right, I've implemented this idea, this open book, policy. How were you able to connect an employee? I don't know how many employees.
We had about 80 at the time.
Well, that's a good number. And so how were you able to connect Joe and Sally into that their job had a specific impact on the bottom line?
Yeah. A lot of training time. Part of it is you actually sit everybody down and spend a half day trying to explain to them even how the financial statements of a business work. You know, you're not trying to make accountants out of them, but you're just trying to give them a general understanding of, here's what we keep score with on the income statement. Here's mm-hmm. what we keep score with on the balance sheet. And so you give them the basic knowledge, but then you do weekly huddles to where you're sharing the financial information on a weekly basis, and they're looking at it. So you're getting 52 touch points during the year, because every weekly staff meeting, you're sharing that information and you're looking at it, and they're able to ask questions and, you know, hey, why are we spending so much on that? Or how does this work? Or why does, you know, what if we try this? And then you can actually go try something and then come back to that same meeting with the entire team and they can see the results. You know, we had a new product we were trying to roll out one time, and I had an employee raise their hand in the meeting and she said, why are we spending $20,000 on a website? And we were like, well, because we need to innovate. We're trying to bring new products. This new product we think will help do this and this and this. And we said, you know, but we need to see a return on that. And so our goal is to make this many sales by the end of September. And if that's not happened, then we're going to, you know, scrap that project. Well, guess whose hand went up at the meeting in the 1st of October? Maria.
She did.
You know, raises her hand and says, hey, how did that work out? you spent $20,000 of our money on a website.
Oh my gosh.
And to your point of earlier, you know, there's a bonus tied to that. So this yes. is coming out of their bonus pool in their mind.
So now they do have a stake in the outcome.
Exactly. And they've got an interest in what's going on. And so we had to tell her in that meeting, hey, we didn't meet our sales goals. And we're going to scrap that whole product line. And that was an investment that didn't pay off. But guess what? We're going to try something else, because yeah. as a business, we have to continue to try to evolve. And they understand that over time. And so they bring ideas to the table then too, and become part of that solution instead of just thinking, oh, Frank's got to figure this out.
Well, and just think about too, or just thinking about what you're talking about. And as I think about the downturn, the big downturn, and 08 and 09 and all of that. I mean, for having the whole company all rowing the boat in the same direction and actually understanding what's above water.
Yeah. No, we were, when we went into 09, our business cut in half during the downturn.
Wow.
And we did several things. We were able to go to our employees and say, we have this much in cash reserves. We're not going to lay anybody off until cash reserves drop down to this amount.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I've got 80 people staring at cash reserves. So nothing's getting spent that shouldn't be spent at that
highly
point.
Highly motivated.
Exactly. So that part was great. But even the better part was my sales guys came to me and said, hey, we know we lost this customer 2 or 3 years ago. And they went to China to buy their seatbelts. But they have to buy a whole container load when they go to China. We think if we can sell them a weekly amount of seatbelts for their production facility at our higher price that they'll be willing to take that because it's a cash flow problem. It's not a seatbelt problem. It's a cash flow problem. So they went to a very large company here in the United States and said, hey, we can send you seatbelts every week to meet your production needs so you don't have all this cash outlay. And they agreed to take our higher price and buy belts from us. And we even knew it was only going to last for, you know, 7 or 8 months. Uh-huh. And then they'd go back to China. But it gave us the business during this interim time. And that wasn't my idea. It wasn't our accounting team's idea of monitoring cash flow. These were the sales guys that understood how cash flow worked because we had trained them on how important cash flow is in a business. And they're coming to me saying, hey, we think we can go back to this customer and win their business back for a time. And it got us through the downturn because the sales guys were monitoring cash flow for a large manufacturing company.
Well, I just bet that there are people listening right now that are thinking, golly, that would have been a much more interesting and enjoyable, fulfilling place to work than maybe where they're working right now. And so I'm wondering, Frank, as you have looked at as you've made a study of this, continue to make study and to train people. I mean, hire with Mosaic personnel. I mean, Mosaic is about placing people in jobs.
Correct. Yeah.
And so you're kind of looking at it from even broader scope.
Yeah, we are. And part of what we try to help monitor on even the Mosaic side is I don't want to place you into a job at a company that's really not going to take care of you when we put you there. So we turn down some business because I don't want to go to sleep at night and worry about the fact that I took you from company A and plugged you in company B. And I know company B likes to yell and scream at their employees. And so, you know, we definitely try to work with that culture piece at Mosaic and figure out what does that culture look like? Is this a place that respects and honors people? And everybody's different from that. So it's not just one size fits all. You know, you can have 4 different companies that are all looking for the same person, and they all have 4 different cultures, and I might only take you and submit you to 2 of those 4 companies because you might only be a culture fit in 2 of those companies, depending on the pace they like to run at and the risk they like to take and the size of the company. All those kind of things matter based on your profile and what kind of job you're going to fit best into. And so we try to take those things into account the best we can when we place people.
You know, Frank, when we were chatting recently, I think about also part of your makeup and what drives you, what themes, let's say from you're a man of faith, you're a Christian,
yes.
you follow Christ, and so are there aspects of the way you see the world let's call it a biblical worldview, from that influences the why and the how that you're walking this stuff out?
Yeah, I think probably the thing that comes to my mind most is, first off, I think God created us to work. Work is actually a gift.
Yep.
And when you're doing something you really enjoy, we've all experienced that, sometimes not at our 8-to-5 job. It may be a hobby or something mm-hmm. like that you do, but you know, you get such a sense of satisfaction from work. And so I've always kind of believed that I was designed to work, and so I should be working. And that's been an important piece of that, is to try to help people find that. When I talk to someone who hates their job and just dreads going to work, I literally get an ill feeling in my stomach, probably because I can empathize with them because I've been there and I understand that. But that's kind of my driving passion of, you know, even if you work for me and I'm not the right place for you to work, I'm excited to, hey, how can we help you find where you've got these great skills and you can go work somewhere else? Because you should be excited about coming to work every day. And so that's the underlying theme, I think, is that that's how God created us. And he wants us to get that fulfillment out of work. And I get to help people try to find that.
Which is a lot of fun. And
yeah.
You know, so there are probably some things when we think about or some patterns, let's call it patterns on companies that, that really just things are not working right. Would you say there are, you know, I don't know, 1, 2, 3 common mistakes, or they may not even be a mistake. They may be the ill-advised, mal-advised, just methodology, you know, some people use, but are there some common ones?
Well, that's a great question. And I have to think through that for just a minute. Probably the first thing that's comes to my mind gets back to opening remark I made about the messiness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I really kind of, I think I see the biggest mistakes get made is people don't realize when you step into a leadership role, you're stepping into messy, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And if you don't want that messy, then that's fine, but just don't step into a leadership role.
Yeah.
And, you know, even when I'm doing some of my executive coaching and some of the people that I work with, they view, you know, meetings, they view interaction with you as this needs to be efficient. We need to get, you know, run through. I need to manage you. I need to, you know, just we need to have this conversation as quick as possible, get to a decision and move on. Is that really how people like to live their life? I mean, you know, you send me an email and we'll figure this out. I mean, again, it gets back to the work relationship and the home relationships are similar. Of you didn't court your wife through email, more than likely, maybe in today's day, maybe somebody's done that.
Are you
that.
Still married? If you did.
But it's you've got to take that time. And so people just don't really recognize the fact that it's about building relationships. And when I have a one-on-one meeting with you, one of the biggest benefits of that meeting is just us to get to know each other. And if we're going to work together, for me to know stuff about you and you to know stuff about me, and we didn't get to a business decision on some project, but we have a trust that's building that as we continue that relationship, that's going to benefit us. And so it's a time issue that I think most people, we're just busy and, you know, same way with our families.
You
don't spend enough time with your spouse or your kids.
Yeah.
And anytime you start missing on that time element, relationships start to drift in the opposite direction that they need to. And so you always have to come back to that intentional relationship building with anyone that's in your organization.
Well, you know, what you're really saying is so much is it's kind of like a do unto others as you would have done unto you, you know, or love your neighbor.
Yes.
I mean, as you'd like to be loved. I mean, these are kind of common sense things.
Right. Which are never common.
No, that's so true.
Yeah. And even if we know it, we just get sucked into, you know, I've got to get a lot done today. And, you know, I've noticed even in my own leadership, when I seem really busy, my staff won't come to me because they're like, oh, I can tell. I mean, they can tell by the pace I'm walking through the office whether or not I can be interrupted or not.
Uh-huh.
And every now and then someone will come up to me and said, well, I've been meaning to talk to you about this for a couple of weeks, but you've seemed really busy.
Ooh.
And oh, it is. It's just like a dagger. They don't mean it that way.
Just the messages. But you're sending nonverbal
exactly, yeah.
stuff.
Just the way you walk through the office and don't stop and greet people, maybe because you are. You've got something important. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, when I've done that, it wasn't that I was working on unimportant things. I had something important to do, but it's a great reminder that, you know, these people need your time, and that's equally as important as any meeting you've got with the bank or a client, your staff. Is on an equal basis with that.
It's almost like, almost what I'm hearing you say is that in some respects, a good business book would be a good book on relationships.
Oh, it absolutely would be. I know of one of my clients, he has a degree in business and a degree in psychology. And I'm like, that's brilliant, you know, because you need both of those things to go together.
Uh-huh.
And that's relationships are just complex, and it takes time to work through them and get to know how to best work with an individual and what is it they're trying to accomplish and help them to do that. And there's no way you do that in a hurry.
So, okay. So you no way you do it in a hurry. So that makes me think of, so let's say here's the situation in which you have somebody you've been coaching, let's mm-hmm. say, and they are well-meaning. They get it. And so now they've come back to the ship, and they issue the command, this is the way it's going to be. And then, so, but there's a distance between the utterance, this is the way things are going to be, and actually things becoming the way they're going to be.
I mean, right.
So how do you make sure that you cross the finish line on that? I mean, so what do you say to the small business person that's listening, or that, and Frank, I don't want to lose track of this thought. I mean, the person that's not even, I mean, if we think about culture, you don't always have to be the boss to shift the culture.
Right.
And so, but how do you, what do you tell that person about? So what are the steps that you take to make sure that good intentions actually end up with a new and uplifting culture?
Yeah. Boy, you're throwing some heat here trying to figure these out.
I know you've been sitting at home with working remotely, and I am trying to, I got a call from Heidi, his wife, and she said, could you really put him through his mental paces today? Right. I think he needs a spark.
Yeah, probably where I would start with that is, you know, there are a lot of surveys out there that talk about why people leave their job. And if you look at kind of a compilation of those surveys, salary ends up somewhere around fourth, typically, on mm-hmm. those surveys, some as low as seventh. The top three reasons why people leave their job: lack of clear expectations, lack of being listened to, and lack of being recognized for the work that they do. So when I'm working with a client, I start with that a lot of times. And I don't know if my percentages are accurate, but I would say if you can accomplish those three things, I can solve 90% of the problems you're having.
And you can also stay married.
Exactly. But it all gets back to relationships.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
And I really hadn't thought about this until we've been chatting about this. I thought, oh my goodness gracious, this is real similar.
And to your point to that, one of the things that I know my clients get tired of hearing me talk about as well, you know, how many people have you heard say, you know, oh, staff meetings are too long, we have too many meetings. And while I agree, you can have too many meetings, meetings are very important. And I compare meetings to family dinner. Family dinner is not about how quickly can we eat the meal, how efficiently can we get food into our mouth. Family dinner is about, hey, let's sit around the table and talk about how our day was.
Yeah.
And when you see what best practices for best families are, that's usually high on the list of, oh, they eat together at least four times a week.
Or,
you know, business is the same way. We get in the focus sometimes of that business meeting is just about, you know, what are we doing this week? How's it going to happen? And let's get out of here and get to work. No, the meeting is the work. The meeting is family dinner. And you never know when little Johnny has something he needs to say this mm-hmm. week when he hadn't said anything for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to be there to listen to that when he has that to say. The same way in your employee meeting, you never know when somebody has something they need to either talk about or something that they can mention that can solve one of the business problems as well. But if you don't take that time and you rush people to get them out of that room and to get on to the real work. So my argument with my clients is always staff meetings are the family dinner that everybody says you need in a family, but seems to try to run from in a business circumstance.
You know, as I mentioned a minute ago, I'm just thinking about, I mean, I've worked in a difficult culture one time. I remember that, but I also think about the people, and I know there's some folks listening right now that they're not the person in charge, but I don't know that they necessarily understand how much they can actually influence culture. They can shift the culture. They don't have to be the boss. They just need to own it. What would you say to them? I mean, what would be your advice to somebody who's the barista at a at a coffee shop, and she's just seeing some cultural shift. I mean, how does she step into that and be a change agent?
A couple of thoughts come to my mind. One is just model it with the people that you do have an influence on, whether those are coworkers, mm-hmm. they don't necessarily have to be downstream from you. They could be peers mm-hmm. or whatever, but nobody ever turns away someone that's respectful and honoring and caring, mm-hmm. Of people. So one, just model that to the people that you do interact with. The other piece that I would, and it probably shows that I do have a bit of a lack of patience on my side. If you don't see that that's gaining any traction upstream, mm-hmm. go fish in a different pond.
Yeah.
Unplug and go work. I mean, it's, culture does get dictated from the top down, ultimately, because you just don't have enough control. I mean, if you can get to know that boss and you can convince them that, hey, this might be a better technique to use on, my coworkers, that's fantastic. But if you try that technique and you just run into a brick wall and you're not getting anywhere, it's probably not going to change, and you're just going to be frustrated the whole time you work there. And then, again, those are the people I run into that give me that sick feeling in my stomach when I hear them talk about that they don't like going to work. And so there's nothing wrong with unplugging and going to work somewhere else.
Well, so what's for our mythical employee, Barista Sarah, whose manager is a tyrant,
right,
and is living in a kind of a Darwinian survival of the fittest work experience, and so now she's looking for someplace else. How and let's say that she doesn't know anybody working there. How does Sarah discern whether it's a good working environment? It looks like it might be okay, and let's say she doesn't. I mean, what would be the pathway that you would suggest for her? I mean, I know that you might Google, you do these things, but let's say there's no talk.
Right. Yeah. You can go to the glass doors of the world and find some reviews typically of places, but it's a limited perspective a lot of times that you get from those. It's in that interview process. I've given my own kids the same advice when they go on an interview. Mm-hmm. Look for any red flag that you can find. If you feel like this person's dismissive of you in the interview, if you feel like you asked some good questions and they didn't really know what the clear direction of the company was, or if they couldn't describe the culture to you, those are all red flags, because the person that's interviewing you is on their best behavior as well.
Yeah.
So it's not going to get any better than that interview. And so if you asked questions and they seemed not to really answer your questions, it's going to be that same way when you go to work for that person.
You got a question or two that you particularly like told your kids? Ask this question.
I honestly don't have a specific question in mind. I think it would typically, my thoughts would be around, describe the culture to me, explain to that, and then listen for, are they describing perks or are they describing how they treat people? And those are two different things.
Oh.
If you're telling me you've got ping pong tables and, nap rooms and those kind of things, those aren't really the culture. Uh-huh. Those are just things that, hey, this company makes enough money, they can afford those things, which are great, but they're not really the culture. The culture comes around to, how do you help people? What are the professional development things that you try to do for your employees? What do you see as the way the company invests in its people? Who do you see succeeds here well? Mm-hmm. And trying to understand a little bit about, the people inside the business more so than even what the product is or any of those type of questions.
You made a comment to me that I thought was really interesting, and it was just one. There was this one comment in the last 12 years, but this one was really based. It was a point of view that you had from your observation of God, and how you have observed him to work in your journey. So you, in fact, your comment was, and I wrote this down, he says, I have seen this over and over in my journey. I don't see a way out. Business seems to be over. And then God does what God does, and something opens up that I never saw coming. And how many people have you heard say that they went through something really hard, but that it was actually a great blessing? It gives me hope. Now, this was it. It gives me hope when things get tough. Unpack that, would you?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
That's you. That's your comment.
Yeah, I know. Those tough times, those are tough times. And so just unpacking it brings back a lot of different thoughts and emotions.
We can bring some Kleenex
in. Yeah, we may need to. You know, we get tied in, and I've grown up in the church all my life, and we get focused on individual scriptures. And one day it just kind of dawned on me that there's a bigger picture here. It's the forest and not the trees. The trees are important. I'm not going to say that individual scripture is not valuable. But when you read through the Bible over and over again, God gets he allows his people to be in spaces that they don't know how they're going to get out of. I mean, hey, I'm going to take you out of Egypt. Well, and so you walk out of Egypt and now you're up against the Red Sea. And the Egyptians are coming at you. Well, we have the benefit. We've seen this on flannel graphs all of our life. We don't get too stressed out about it.
Yeah.
These people were terrified for their lives. And all of a sudden, the sea opens up and they walk across. You know, again, Daniel in the lion's den. He didn't know he wasn't going to be ripped apart by the lion when he stepped in there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Mm-hmm. You know, they even said before they went in, hey, our God can save us, but if he chooses not to, he's still our God. Wow, and you're jumping into the furnace? I mean, you know, yeah. But I've seen that over and over again in my life, in business. You know, there were times when product liability on the seatbelt business is not a fun place to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, it looks like, man, this is going to go bad. There's no way that I see out. And then the next thing you know, God opens a door. We had an insurance company that wouldn't come to the table and settle a product liability issue with us. And I remember my lawyer, he said, this ends with you on the beach. And I was like, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, we're going to have to sue the insurance company. If you win, you don't have to worry about working again, and you can live on the beach. If you lose, you'll be digging for your next meal out of the trash can on the beach. And wow. I'm like, wow, I don't like the odds on this because it was a very large insurance company that I'm having to file a lawsuit against because they're not coming to the table to act in my best benefit. And God resolved that situation. But, you know, we were literally days from closing the doors. And, you know, you go into the 2008, 2009 recession and business cuts in half and you're like, wow, how in the world do we come through this? You walk into a pandemic and business shuts down. You know, we've seen 60, 70% decreases in our business during this pandemic time. And I just have to have that hope that God's shown up in one way or another that I would never have figured out, but he does. And we've got that history,
yes.
Which I think is why he gave us those stories to realize, hey, I'm going to see you through these things. They won't be easy, but I'm there with you. And so you just move forward a day at a time and trust that he's going to come through. And that may not look how I want it to. It may not be with my business surviving, but eternally, which is what he's really interested in, is guaranteed. And that part just helps me to stay focused and plug through the day-to-day when you can't see literally what 2 days out from now is going to be.
Boy, Frank, that's so good. You know, I just so identify with that. I mean, you know, what our idea of a good outcome is not necessarily what his idea of a good outcome. And he's got the 30,000-foot view.
Yeah.
And we don't. I can't tell you, I identify with what you're saying so much, because I think about, and I know people right now listening in, they may be at that kind of moment. I mean, they may be people that are out of work, from the pandemic, or for whatever reason. And so there's kind of a state of it could be despair. You know, I mean, what's next? What next? But I tell you what, I marvel though now, and as you get older, you know, like me, you look back and you've got a range of time to look at, and your range isn't as long as my range, but still you got some time to look at and see how God operates and everything. And I marvel at moments in which, man, I thought I was going to have a different outcome, and the world would say even that the outcome that I had was a loss,
right?
And yet I marvel at how God was able to wrap all that up into something that was actually, as they say, for my good and for His glory. And like, dang, that's true. Again and again and again and again.
Yeah. One of the books that really kind of helped pull some of this together for me was, I believe the name of it's Me, Myself, and Bob. And it's by Phil Vischer, the guy that created VeggieTales.
Oh, yeah.
And if you haven't heard the VeggieTales story, I mean, VeggieTales was obviously this massive success,
yes.
And he partnered with another company in order to help with the distribution and ended up losing the entire thing. And through the book, he goes through all the details of kind of how that happened, but he kept waiting for the seed to part. You know, even when he was sitting in the courtroom, it was like, wow, God's going to come through in a big way and save VeggieTales for me. And that's not how it worked. And he lost VeggieTales and ended up having to walk away from his own creation that, you know, kids all over the world were, you know, enjoying. But again, when you talk and read the end of his book, he's moved on to something else. He sees that what he's doing now is, you know, having an amazing impact. And, you know, it was not the fairy tale that he thought, where God was going to split the sea and he was going to walk across on dry land. But he still found a way out for him, and he still survived, and eternity, which is the real hope, is still intact. And it really, reading through that, you just kind of read that book, and it was a little, you know, sad and depressing, but at the same time, it's just like, okay, the perspective here. What are we here for? And it's not to have a successful business or whatever. It's to model and reflect Him in whatever journey you're walking through, and to handle that in the right way. And so that's always been one of those books that just sticks in my head of, didn't like the ending of that, but wow, that was powerful and helpful in my own walk of what's really important here.
Yeah, because again, we just don't have the 30,000 foot view.
Yeah.
So what would you say to the person that is, that would be that kind of a very practical life journey kind of advice on some body listening that's wanting to take the next right step towards living a hope-filled and purposeful existence?
Understand yourself and know what skills you really have and what skills you really don't have. And so, you know, when I look back at my career, places when I've really enjoyed working there were certain types of companies, certain sizes of company. And so I've really kind of looked back over my career and say, okay, big companies aren't a great fit for me usually, because, you know, if I take the right assessments, it'll tell you that I'm structure averse, and I understand the need for structure in a big business. I just don't like to be constrained by a lot of structure and policies and procedures. So for me personally, that means I'm going to work in small business more of my life. I may work and have clients that are big business that I can impact in a culture way at their big business, but I need to kind of focus in a small business. And I think a lot of times the world kind of dictates that, hey, success is being part of a big company and being the CEO mm-hmm. or the president of a big company. That's not how God created me. And so when I really stop and kind of try to take inventory of what am I good at, I'm good at one-on-one conversations with people. I'm good at thinking about the business culture in a very different way than a lot of businesses do. I'm better in small companies than I am in big companies. So where should my career be? Mm. And to find that sweet spot and to kind of let my ego go that I don't need to be the CEO of Starbucks to be a business success. I can be the CEO of a 6-person business and be a huge success and have impact on thousands and thousands of people. And that's what God's created me for. So I've got to really look at what am I really good at? And then try to find a place where that fits versus trying to fit somewhere that sounds neat. And so my ego can get in my way.
Boy, Frank, that's a big comment right there, because our ego and what we think. I remember in my 20s being on the phone with a buddy of mine from college, and I don't know why we were having this conversation, but it kind of also points to the immaturity, I guess, that we were suffering from at the time, and so we're talking about what we're going to do. Well, we're both in college, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I just knew, and this was my quote: "I want to be the head honcho of the biggest entity possible." Like, it had nothing to do with whether I was qualified. I just wanted the title.
Yeah.
And so it was all ego. And so the what you talked about on the importance of really getting real with yourself, talking to people that care about you and ask, what do you see in me? What do you see as my sweet spot? I mean, and really drilling down. That is just such a game changer for folks to do just what you talked about, let go of the ego and really examine, what am I really good at? What do I have a passion for? What do I enjoy?
Yeah. And one of the ways I've done that is just asking my wife, when in my business career have you seen me the happiest? And she can give good. A very different perspective than, I can. And she was able to pinpoint pretty quickly that you're really happy when you're building something, when it's kind of new and fresh and you're building it. And so that's been a huge eye-opener to me. I ran into a guy early in my career, and he was on the third bank. In the short time I'd known him, he was working on with the third bank. And I said, man, why are you on the third bank already? Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm good at taking a bank from point A to point B. When I get them to point B, I unplug and go find another bank that is at point A that wants to get to point B. And he said, that's going to be my entire career. And I've kept up with him, and he's on bank number 6. And
well, see, that's a beautiful thing.
It's amazing. What a wonderful gift.
He knows what he's good at, and he doesn't stay where he's not so good at.
And so that, again, was one of those puzzle pieces for me that's kind of always stuck in the back of my head of, okay, what is that sweet spot? Where do I need to stay? And, I find that even in businesses. I understand, like I mentioned, the need for structure when a business gets big. I just don't like to operate in that environment. So I'm good from the creation to mm-hmm. that phase. But once it gets to a certain point, then it's better for me to step off and go find the next thing to help build. Versus to stay on too long. And you see that with a lot of entrepreneurs that stay on with their business too long and kind of become the bottleneck mm-hmm. with that. And so, again, it's back to that self-awareness, which that's the number one trait for good leaders.
Well, Frank, this has really been good. This is what meaty stuff. I mean, I guess you do some executive coaching.
I do, yes.
Yeah. So any of y'all out there listening, I mean, you've got a pretty nice little sip of what's coming out of the fountain here. And so I really thank you for
Happy
your time.
To.
I thank you for what you've shared. I just think there's just a man, there's just a lot of meat to that, and people would be well advised. I mean, really, what you're really talking about is being character filled individuals.
Well, thanks for having me on. I enjoy talking about this all the time. I mean, this is why God gave me the gifting that he did.
This is your sweet spot.
Exactly.
I bet that is a lot of fun. Getting to coach and to talk about the things that you know and you love and to see that inspire other people has really got to be a reward in and of itself.
Yeah, it's very rewarding. It's just so much fun to have that impact in people's lives.
Well, Frank Smith, thank you very much. God bless you, my friend. And we'll see the rest of you all next time.
Thank you.
So let me give you some concluding thoughts. If Hope were a person in the room, what would she say to us? Well, I think, first of all, she'd say that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that an unchanging God designed, built you, and sent you into a moment of history as part of his loving strategy to transform a chaotic world and make it good again. You are called as change agents. Hope would tell you that she flourishes when we listen to God and set goals for our lives that press us further toward becoming that person God has always been willing for us to become. Hope would tell you to set action steps towards achieving those goals. They don't have to be giant steps. Start with baby steps so you can be encouraged along the way. But Hope would also tell you that you've got to not just make plans to step, but you must exercise the willpower to just take that next right step. Step by step by step gets you to the destination God has for your life. It's the long obedience in the same direction. And finally, Hope would tell you that God sees us not as we are, but as we could become if we will dare. It's the same for our communities. As followers of Jesus, you are a sent people, and all humans should flourish because God's kids are in town. What evil thing dies because you exist? No one else is coming. You're the generation sent to your community in this moment. You're it. Press into God's purposes for your lives, and you will discover that hope abounds and that Jesus is still the God of the impossible. Once again, I'd be honored if you would take a moment to rate this podcast, review it, subscribe, and share it with someone who needs hope. We want to thank Brianna Gaither for the song I Won't Rest Until from her album Vanity. Remember, you are fearfully and wonderfully made by a God who is willing for us to live meaningful lives of profound impact. I invite you to just show up and watch God show off.